Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. White nationalist demonstrations have sprung up around the country in the past 2 years, calling for the United States to be a dominion of European white control. Most notable was a clash between white supremacists and counter-demonstrators in Charlottesville, Virginia, in August 2017. That day, a 20-year-old man from Ohio drove his car into a group of counter-demonstrators. One woman died and 19 others were injured in the attack. Today, we're talking about what attracts a person to such a hate group and what happens when they want to leave that group. Part of the process for many involves removing or camouflaging tattoos of dedication to the movement. A new documentary entitled Beneath the Ink considers the work of Zanesville tattoo artist Billy Joe White, who dedicates part of his business to covering up white nationalist tattoos for free. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show, Billy Joe.
Hey, how you doing today, Ann?
Good, thanks. You were watching a Vice program on HBO about the Charlottesville attack when it occurred to you to do this. What did you see that inspired you?
Well, you know, I'm just sitting there on my couch. You know, I'm just sitting in my house, and I'm just taking this all in. You know, obviously the climate that is our nation right now is a little bit hostile. So, you know, I'm trying to take it in from every angle. So, you know, I'm watching this this transfold and transpire, and you know, it just really hit me, you know, and it really put things to perspective that, you know, the people are actually out here. They are putting their foot down. They want to stand up for what they believe in, and you know, they're dying because of that. And you know, there are people that are trying to walk away, and there are trying to people that are to better their lives. So I just felt like I had to do something, you know.
How did you know that you would have customers? I mean, obviously, it's a free something you do for free, but that there was a clientele for this. How did you know they were out there?
Well, I mean, I've been tattooing now for 14 years, so I've definitely came across it just in my regular day practices. You know, you see it. You don't necessarily, and a lot of times people haven't even asked me about the cover-up process or anything like that until you know, I spoke out and was like, yo, I'm going to do these things for free. You know, this is a non-judgment zone. You know, we're good. But, I mean, just in my area, you know, in southeastern Ohio growing up, I mean, that was the rhetoric around here. So, I mean, I knew they existed, and they most certainly do.
What kind of tattoos did you see that reflected this movement?
I mean, and we saw everything. We saw portraits of Adolf Hitler. We saw swastikas. Of course, swastikas was a pretty common thing. We saw Klansmen. I covered up a 14-inch Klansman on a guy's back with a burning cross that he had had for, you know, years and years and years and years and years. I mean, we saw it all, literally everything that you could imagine. The portrait of Hitler was really just the whoa, okay, like you've been walking around with this thing forever is really mind-blowing to me.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking this hour about the radicalization to hate groups. My guest right now is Billy Joe White. He's the owner of Red Rose Tattoo in Zanesville. There's a documentary out, Beneath the Ink. It focuses on Billy's work to cover up, to camouflage tattoos that reflect white supremacist political ideals, as he said, including portraits of Adolf Hitler, images of Klansmen, and other kinds of symbols, swastikas and so forth. If you have a question or comment for Billy Joe White, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can check out the All Sides Facebook page. You know, we'd love to hear from people today who have been radicalized one way or another. There's a lots of different ways. We're going to hear from experts later on in the program, but have worked to get away from different hate groups. If you're one of those people, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Were you ever asked in all of your years as a tattoo artist, Billy, to design or to make a tattoo of something that you didn't like?
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely.
What do you do?
You just say no. I mean, it's real easy to put your foot down, and I've pretty much I've always just been like that. Mm-hmm. You know, like people will try to entice you with large amounts of money, and it's just, you know, like you really, I can't co-sign that, and I've never been able to co-sign that, and you couldn't pay me enough to. So, you know, for me, it was always a really easy answer, just to be like, nah, and you need to go. No one here is going to do that for you, you know.
And when you talk about doing this for free for people, what sort of investment is it on your in as far as your time goes?
You know what? And it's like one of those things that I don't know if you can really put like a monetary kind of thing. You know, I did do one tattoo for a guy who had asked me. He was like, "Yo, if I did have to pay for this tattoo, what would it be?" And, you know, I told him my hourly rate, you know, and it saved him, you know, hundreds of dollars. You know, it was a multi-session tattoo. It was over three procedures to get it finally knocked out. And, you know, so, yeah, it's money. But to me, it's like it's not worth even, you know, I would do it, and I will do it for the rest of my life for free, because to me, it's not worth it. It's not worth people not being able to move forward because they don't have a couple $100 or they don't have, you know, the ability to, like, walk in and say, hey, I've made a mistake, and I am looking to move forward. So I think when I was able to say, yo, this is for free, and we don't care about your story, we don't care about why you want to cover it up, we just want to get it off the streets, and, you know, 95% of the people that we've dealt with, you know, have really has taken the steps beyond just a free tattoo, you know, to really make those changes in their life. So
do they tell their stories ever?
Oh yeah, you know, for sure. Again, because like when you're accepting to every ideology and understanding that, you know, listen, we don't understand anybody's lives really beyond ourselves, and sometimes we don't even really understand those, that you just, people are willing to talk to you and be open and honest and, you know, finally say the things. You know, some of these people were telling me stories that no one's ever heard, or no one's, that they've never even vocalized. And, you know, being able to talk with them and speak to them about, you know, listen, that's in the past now, and you've obviously figured that out, and that's why you're here. And, you know, it's awesome. We did run into a couple people that definitely, I don't think the ideology had changed for them. They just wanted to get a cool new tattoo. Mm. But at the same token, I struggled with that for a little bit. Mm-hmm. But then at the end of the day, you know, it was just like, yo, I had to take my ego out of it. And I had to say, as long as somebody doesn't see that at the pool, someone doesn't have to see that at, you know, you walking down the street, or, you know, it's saving them from that hardship. It's saving them from seeing it. And mindful, you know, like, I'm still doing a service. I'm still doing something that I truly believe in. And whether or not they ever come to terms with their hatred, that's really on them. You know, I've done my part to be able to say, like, yo, I am doing what I can to get this off the streets and to make it a little bit better.
For people that you've worked with who had been held back by the tattoo, tell us about people who, what the tattoo represented and how it held them back.
Oh, I mean, like, I can think specifically that, you know, we had met with a guy who had a swastika on his neck. Now, he didn't want to, he couldn't move forward. He literally couldn't move forward. And, like, I think he had done some jail time. And he was working at, like, a fast food restaurant. And he had, like, kind of plateaued. He wasn't able to move even higher into management, even though, like, they knew that he was capable of doing so. Mm-hmm. But that tattoo on his neck, you know, they couldn't have that as the face of their thing. So, you know, he was able to get that covered up. Jen, who works with me, you know, everybody in the shop is on board with this. Mm-hmm. I have three people that work here with me that they're, we all have the same ideology. We're all down for this.
Mm-hmm.
So she did the cover up for him, you know, and now he's a manager. You know, he was able to take that next step. And, you know, like just seeing these people smile and seeing them like, man, like you could literally see the weight lifted off their chest. Hmm. Knowing like, oh, I can take my shirt off now. You know, I don't have to feel so embarrassed. You know, one of the guys in the documentary, John, he, his story is really, really, really unbelievable.
How so?
And, I mean, John, he's the guy that had the big flaming swastika on his back.
Mm-hmm.
His family dynamic, he came from it. There was a lot of it going on. And his grandfather and his great, you know, like it's passed down here. It's not just something one day maybe you wake up and you all of a sudden have all this hate in your heart. A lot of times you're conditioned and, you know, not making excuses, but that's a lot of what I've seen.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, John had walked past that for years and had moved on from that and actually had adopted, you know, a son who was colored.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for him to be able to, like, have to, you know, he wore a shirt around his house forever. You know, he was so embarrassed by that that, you know, he didn't want his son to ever know and never see that crap.
Mm-hmm.
So when he was able to get that covered up, I mean, he had another one on his stomach. I mean, we've taken care of John, you know. Mm-hmm. And he's so thankful, and he's just so appreciative, and it really does. It's changed people.
What kind of reaction have you gotten from the community that endorses these hate kind of groups and these ideas of Nazism and neo-Nazis and white supremacy?
Right. Well, I mean, I can't lie and say that I was definitely not fearful that I wasn't my shop wasn't going to get firebombed or there would be a brick thrown through the window or, you know, something like that. And I guess that still could happen any day, you know, like, and that's just the reality of life. Like, I personally haven't had anybody come to me and say, hey, dude, stop that, you know, or what you're doing is stupid. Like, everybody can do what, but these people have all moved past it, you know? So I think beyond what the people who are endorsing it, you know, neo-Nazis, Nazism, you know, whatever it may be,
mm-hmm.
They're not coming towards me. You know, they're not saying anything towards me. But I think they also know that I'm down for the dialect. I'm down to have the conversation.
Mm.
And if they want to have the conversation, then we can have it. But, you know, as far as like any kind of backlash, I've been blessed to say that we haven't really had anything yet. It's all been really positive. You know, moving forward, I hope it continues.
Have you seen the documentary?
Oh yeah, yeah. I've seen it once in the theater. I actually have a copy of it myself as well. And I try not to watch it. I've watched it a couple of times with my girlfriend. And it's just been one of those things where you're like, I can't even kind of believe this ever happened. When Cy approached me about it, you know, it was one of those things where I was like, yeah, sure, man, come on out. And, you know, I never thought it was going to ever happen. And here it is, you know, we've done something that I'm very, very, very proud of. You know, I never would have guessed that it would have kind of, you know, hit the ground running as well as it has, but it has. So I feel really lucky.
Well, Billy Joe White, thanks for joining us today to talk about it. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, no problem. If you guys are out there on Sunday, this
mm-hmm.
Sunday at 6:30 at the Drexel, we're going to be opening up.
Oh, you're going to be there?
Yeah, we're
okay.
going to be there. So the film will be showed. Cy's got a couple other films that will be showed
okay.
as well. And they're all amazing, completely amazing. So if you guys don't have anything to do Sunday night at the Drexel Theater, stop on by. We'll all be there.
Okay, that's a Central Ohio premiere of Beneath the Ink at Drexel Theater in Bexley on Sunday, July 29. I think doors open at 6 p.m. You'll see Beneath the Ink focuses on the work that Billy Joe White, owner of Red Rose Tattoo in Zanesville, is doing to help people recover, reform, whatever, from their previous devotion to white supremacy and white nationalist groups. So more on for that. You can check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. More coming up. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. White nationalism, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, is a belief that white identity should be the organizing principle of the countries that make up Western civilization. This is a form of radicalization similar to that of the Nazis in World War II Germany or ISIS in the present-day Middle East. Radicalization is a similar process no matter where or when in the world it might be happening. David Weber is an assistant professor at Virginia Commonwealth University. He's studied radicalization, and he joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Is there a difference? Tell us what you mean, what we mean by hate organization and the radicalization movement therein.
Okay, so when we talk about radicalization, what we're talking about, as researchers here, is a process where normal individuals come to believe, endorse, and act upon some kind of political or ideological form of violence. That's what we talk about when we talk about radicalization.
It happens in a lot of different ways. We just heard from Billy Joe White, owner of Red Rose Tattoo in Zanesville, that a lot of the people he works with to cover up their hate tattoos grew up that way.
Yeah, absolutely. We find that often, you know, some people are introduced to it maybe early in their youth years, but when it comes to certain ideologies and kind of certain kind of niche beliefs within societies, we do find that people are often raised that way as well. Mm-hmm. With Islamic extremists, we sometimes refer to it as kind of being bred within the bone. Other researchers have referred to it that way.
Is that tougher to crack?
I don't know if it's necessarily tougher to crack. I think we would say that extremists, regardless of whether they came into it later on in their life or early on, they're probably doing it for very similar reasons. The research that my colleagues and I do, we look at radicalization as being, as really resulting from what we call a motivational imbalance. So most people, we don't engage in violent or immoral or negative actions because doing so harms or goes against other things or other goals or motives that are important for us. But extremists are willing to put their lives at risk. They're willing to give up careers. They're willing to forego important relationships to fight for this cause. And we see that kind of that motivational imbalance that allows them to be willing to kind of do all of those negative actions while at the same time harming other important motives and goals that people have just towards achieving everyday life. That would be common in all extremists.
What's out of balance?
What's out of balance? So yeah. What we would say is typically when you make a decision to do something, right, you weigh it against things that are more that are also important, right? So if I make a decision to do something, but I know that that action might put my life in physical danger, or I know that that action would risk relationships with other people, I might think twice about that. But what extremists have is they're so focused on achieving one goal that's singularly important to them, that one has been kind of moved so important that other concerns have now become less important. And so now they don't have that kind of mental arithmetic that they have to go through. They're willing to do these violent things. They're willing to put their life at risk because that's singularly what they're focused on. And the reason we see that in our research is because we see that these individuals, what's really going on is that they see extremism and they see belonging to these hate groups and terrorist organizations as a potent way to provide them with this need to feel important. It's kind of an innate need that all of us have to feel important, to mm-hmm. feel valued, to feel like other people in the world respect us. And extremists see belonging to these organizations and fighting for these organizations as the way that they can achieve those feelings. And so they're willing to do whatever it takes to get those important feelings.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about how people become radicalized. My guest is David Weber. He's an assistant professor at Virginia Commonwealth University. He has studied the process of radicalization. If you have a question or comment for David Weber, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Social networks or social media has come to play a big role in the radicalization of, you know, ISIS, to attract people to the organization ISIS. Is that playing a big role across the board when it comes to radicalization, David Weber?
Yeah, absolutely. I think as technology changes and as people in their everyday lives start to use different forms of technology, we would expect that extremist organizations and terrorist organizations would also adopt these different forms of technology. So it's definitely playing a role, but I would say that it's really just representative of the changing landscape that we all experience, right? So back in the day, if you wanted to recruit somebody, you would maybe have to show up at their house or have some kind of physical interaction with that individual, and you probably have to navigate kind of clandestine, you know, hidden spaces where you wouldn't get noticed, and you'd have to risk all of that. Today, we have the internet, we have social media, we have all of these networking tools online, which allows these extremist organizations to operate maybe more quickly and more secretively, but also to reach a larger potential pool of recruits. So I would say that it's really representative of a changing kind of time with everybody. But the ramification of that is that it really allows them to operate more quickly, organize more quickly, and to reach a larger number of potential individuals.
A typical radicalized person is what? A male, white, young?
We would say it's going to vary, but typically younger and typically male. That doesn't mean there are not female radicals or extremists out there. We are seeing that different organizations are starting to use female extremists more often. We've also seen like organizations like the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Alam in Sri Lanka. They used women very successfully as suicide bombers. Same thing in the Middle East. You don't necessarily expect a woman to be carrying a suicide bomb on her person. And so although mostly men, mostly younger, we do find that it varies very much. They don't tend to be less educated, and I wouldn't say they tend to be white. That's going to vary based on whatever ideological cause they're fighting for.
Okay. Peg and Marion, you're on the air. Hi, Peg.
Hi. I just have kind of a comment and a question at the same time. I'm really concerned about the negativism in our country at this point, and from our leadership down, and I'm wondering what the impact of that is on our own country in terms of drawing people out or to take on these radical stances, and maybe you could just comment on that.
David Weber?
Yeah, sure. I would say what we've seen here in the U.S. and what we're seeing kind of globally is we've seen a bit the past couple years this wave of populism that is spread. And what that tends to do is populism can get taken into a right side or a leftist perspective, but it has seemed to kind of this kind of fight for your own country, negative attitudes towards foreigners and those types of ideas. They have become stronger. We have seen some right leaning right-wing organizations around the world have kind of been a little bit successful in winning political seats. In the U.S., it seems to have emboldened this population of the U.S., and they're maybe more vocal, more verbal, like we saw the Unite the Right rally almost a year ago, willing to organize these types of things, whereas before they hadn't. So we're seeing a kind of an emboldening of these types of ideas and people within the population.
Peg, thanks a lot for that call. Norma and Hilliard, you're on the air. Welcome, Norma.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
From your opening definition, I was wondering how you distinguish between a good cause of radicalization, or is it radicalization when you fight for a cause that, like, are the men who fought for the Revolutionary War, throughout the British, and who, they made a major upheaval in the colonies, in the form of government, society.
The whole world.
How do you distinguish those people from all these negative examples, and then certainly, like the Ku Klux Klan or the Nazis and whatnot, I mean, really horrible things people do.
That's a good question. David Weber, what is it? Is it a historical context that we don't have yet, or what?
I think, yeah, that definitely plays a role. There's always this, it's kind of a cliche phrase that we hear, but one man's terrorist or extremist is another man's freedom fighter. It's all about kind of your own perspective. Looking at it from the outside, you may view that as terrorism or as an extremist act, but the individual who's engaging on it on their own, they might view themselves as revolutionaries who are trying to fight for their own freedom. So there's kind of a perspective thing, but it's definitely, looking at kind of the context globally, looking context kind of what's acceptable and what's normative, and we can use that to kind of tell us which one is maybe, I don't want to use the word appropriate, but more acceptable versus not.
As far as de-radicalization and that whole process is, and Norma, by the way, thank you for your call. What do we mean by that? Is it just changing your mind about an issue, or is it something deeper?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And so we tend to think of it when it comes to extremists like white supremacists or people who belong to ISIS and Islamic extremists. We define that as ideologically driven violence, right? They're fighting on behalf of some set of ideology or ideals that they believe in. And so we tend to think that if we want to de-radicalize these individuals, what we need to do is address kind of that belief system. Okay, and in a sense, that's absolutely true. So if radicalization is the process whereby somebody comes to believe in these types of things and act upon them, de-radicalization is, in a sense, the inverse process, where now we take people who are extremists, and we try to kind of pull them out of that, and we try to get them so they no longer are willing to endorse or engage in these types of actions. So one way to do that is to go at the ideology, try to correct kind of the negative beliefs that they hold towards certain people or about how the world should be. But we could also go at that. I talked about this kind of motivational imbalance component. We could try to address the motivation. So if these people see extremist organizations as their way to feel important, well, we could try to provide them with alternative ways, right? And so a very effective thing that a lot of disengagement and de-radicalization programs use is they use education programs. So they provide people with an education so they can go get a job, they can better themselves. They provide them with kind of vocational skills so they can, again, get a job and find another way to kind of earn significance, so they don't have to find it solely within that extremist organization.
And is it painful for people to go through de-radicalization? In a way, they're giving something up no matter what.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think another researcher, Pete Simi, he's done work with white nationalists in particular. He's kind of talks about it in the sense that, and it makes a lot of sense, when you become an extremist, you devote your entire life, your entire identity to that, right? You give up all of your relationships outside of that organization, and you only associate with people in the organization. You identify yourself as that extremist, as that person fighting for that cause, and when you start to leave or you break away from that, you're kind of left finding out, trying to find out who you are as a person again, because you now have to re-identify who you are. You have to get new associations, and it can be a very, very difficult process.
You know, we were talking to Billy Joe White, the owner of the Red Rose Tattoo in Zanesville earlier, and he was talking about the tattoos that he helps people camouflage, tattoos that reflected a white, largely a white nationalist or white supremacist, a neo-Nazi type of point of view. What is the role of things like tattoos in radicalization?
Yeah, so tattoos are kind of a way to show your belonging to the group, a way to show your commitment to this organization. Like, if you do truly believe in what we're saying and what we're fighting for, if you're willing to kind of permanently put that on your body, that's a demonstration to the other individuals within the organization and the world that you are truly committed and you are truly going to fight for these types of things. So it sends an important signal to somebody who is trying to, you know, belong in that community, that I'm here and I mean business.
And then therein it becomes kind of a shackle as well.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And in some of the research, we've done some research, my colleagues and I, in Germany with former white nationalists. So these are individuals who they had belonged in these organizations for 5 to 10 years. Many of them had even moved up into leadership organizations within these groups. And what we found is that we coded, we read interviews with them, and we went through and looked at what they were saying. And we found that a lot of them felt like they were discriminated against. And we had measured discrimination, but we were anticipating seeing this as something they would experience early on, and it might drive them to become extremists. Like, they felt foreigners were being treated better than them, and that's why they became extremists. What we found is that while they're extremists and while they're trying to leave, society is treating them as members of extremist organizations, and other relationships, people are kind of cutting ties with them because of this. And we find that that's a very kind of, that's a difficult thing for them to go through, and it makes life very difficult. When you still have that tattoo after you've left the movement, when these individuals leave, right, they're trying to set up new social networks, new ties, have a steady job, and just kind of get back into a mainstream life. But that tattoo is an instant signal that tells people how to treat you. And so they're going to continue to get that form of discrimination and mistreatment once they leave these organizations. And so those initiatives like covering them up would allow them to kind of navigate the real world more successfully.
Before I let you go, turning to Brendan in Dayton. Hi, Brendan. You're on the air.
Well, thank you, Anne. David, I would just like to point out studies by Stanford neurochemist Robert Sapolsky that show that the chemical oxytocin, which was regarded as a feel-good chemical, also creates xenophobia and hatred towards other groups. It is a double-edged sword. You might consider that in your studies, my good man.
Well, Brendan, what's your point?
I just wanted to tell him about those studies that he can put into his work, if I could.
David Weber?
Yeah, thank you. I'd be happy to look into that.
All right. David Weber, thanks to you for your time today. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me.
David Weber is an assistant professor at Virginia Commonwealth University. He has studied radicalization and de-radicalization processes. Coming up, we're going to hear from the executive director of an organization that specifically focuses on de-radicalizing people from hate groups. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the process of radicalization and how some are working to free others from the clutch of white supremacist organizations and culture. Christian Piccolini, the leader of the first neo-Nazi skinhead gang in the United States, addressed this in a November 2017 TEDx Mile High Talk in Denver.
I began to challenge the very important things that drew me to the movement to begin with. Identity, community, and purpose, things that I had been struggling with as a young boy. And now, I struggled with the concept of who I was again.
Piccolini co-founded Life After Hate, a nonprofit that counsels members of hate groups to help them disengage. Joining us now is Executive Director of Life After Hate, Sammy Rangel. Welcome to the show. Featured in a new documentary that will have its Central Ohio debut on Sunday, July 28th. July 29th at 6 p.m. at the Drexel Theater in Bexley. If you want more information on that, check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. And Sammy Rangel, you're back. Welcome. He is the executive director of Life After Hate. What do you think of Life After Hate? Do you know somebody? Why don't you tell us your story and keep me from having to blather on and on. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So we have heard from Billy Joe White, owner of Red Rose Tattoo in Zanesville. He is featured in a new documentary called Beneath the Ink. It's premiering in Central Ohio at the Drexel Theater in Bexley on Sunday, July 29th. If you want to check that out, go to the link on our website at WOSU.org. Have you been a member of a radical group? Have you tried to de-radicalize? Have you tried to leave the group? What has been the problem for you? We'd like to hear your point of view. 614-292-8513. Maybe you're a member of a radical organization and don't think that there should be organizations out there helping people de-radicalize. Tell us what you think about that. 614-292-8513. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I appreciate the people that are calling in now. Be patient while we get to your call. I'm going to turn now to line two. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello, this is Desmond, longtime listener.
Hi, Desmond.
Hello, Ann.
Yeah.
I would like to define the system of white supremacy and how it works.
You would like it defined and how it works?
Yes, I would like a true definition. Because I have my own specific definition, but I'd like to get a caller's definition as well.
Well, the definition that white nationalism, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, is a belief that white identity should be the organizing principle of the countries that make up Western civilization. So,
oh, I understand. Well, my definition, the way I understand it, is that by thought, speech, or action, usually, normally, white heterosexual males usually use dominance or violence to own and control all property, wealth, resources, and information in the world.
And why does that matter?
Why does that matter? Because white supremacy is a global system. If you look back to the Imperial Age, from Britain to Germany, and you can go back to the conference, the Berlin Conference of 1883, also known as the White Man's Burden.
Okay, it's Desmond, right?
Yes, correct.
Desmond, thanks a lot for your call. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Let's take another call, 614-292-8513. Sammy Rangel, are you there?
I am here. I'm on another cell phone. So
thank
let's
you.
Hope this one works better.
This works a lot better. Now, back to my okay. original question. We only have a few minutes, but I have a lot of questions. Why move from a quarterly publication to an actual organization? Is there that much demand?
I think so. And we became aware of that when we were invited to the Summit Against Violent Extremism in Ireland, where they brought former extremists from every walk of life to this summit, as well as victims of violent extremism. And it was there when we decided that we needed to do more and to be more heavily involved, and specifically to do something about the white supremacy issues that our co-founders, including myself, knew were still impacting the U.S. right now.
Why? I guess it had to have been very interesting for you to be at that summit and see people coming from all different points of view, all radicalized, right?
Correct.
What were the common denominators?
Some of the most extremists. Well, the common denominators, I think, were people often felt that they were being prejudiced against, and they were being isolated and segregated and kind of removed from the beneficiaries of society. You know, they were becoming second and third class citizens. And that sentiment was deep and oftentimes had elements of truth to it. And so anything that had that element of truth just kind of lent itself to some of the ideologies that are pushed that eventually lead you to extremism, right? And so a little bit of truth mixed in with a whole lot of hate makes it very persuasive for people who are feeling that they're discounted and that they're never validated.
How organized are these hate groups to recruit young members? I know your co-founder, Christian Picciolini, hopefully I'm not butchering that, was recruited at 14
sure.
years old. How aware are they of that? What do they know?
Well, you know, I think people who are hurting or broken often associate and are quick to see when others are hurt and broken. And a lot of times that brokenness is the uniting energy in the beginning, right? There's a vulnerability there. And when you're vulnerable, you can recognize that vulnerability in others. And then the problem is that instead of helping someone through that, some people prey on that. And I don't know that they themselves see themselves as predators.
Okay.
But obviously those of us looking in can see that's predatory behavior, because they're really using it to advance their own personal causes, their own idea of right and wrong in the world, versus helping someone actually find freedom from the hurt.
Were you a radical, Sammy Rangel?
I actually survived a race riot by the age of 17 fighting white supremacists. And I was a gang member from Chicago, but I was surrounded by all the founding members of those gangs at that time. And so they were feeding me ideology. They were feeding me radicalization. And no one knew that those were even things back then. We just thought they knew something that we didn't. And because they were powerful, we chose to follow them.
And how did you get away from that? What was the moment, that crystalline moment that others have, you know, that you share with others in getting out of that?
You know, you asked if there was a theme, and there certainly is a theme that is rippling through all the men and women that we've helped, including our co-founders. The theme is that when we were at our worst, when we were behaving most violently and most aggressive, there was someone or a handful of people who surrounded us who, despite behaving that way, still treated us and honored us as humans, still treated us and with love and compassion and empathy. But they never communicated, you know, that they agreed with anything we said. They just were validating our existence and validating us as people when we were trying to repel them. Like they weren't, you know, they weren't falling for the defense mechanisms that we had in place to keep them at arm's length. They still found ways into us, and it always seemed to be surrounded by this idea that these people treated us better than we were behaving at that time and even deserved. And that was uncommon for us. That level of acceptance at that, and when we were in that mindset, was so uncommon for us that it kind of shocked the senses. It was a one-off, and it was so different that it made us contemplate our global view of life, that the global view we used to approach life in those days.
Yeah, we only have like about 30 seconds or 45 seconds left, Sammy, but can you tell me, if somebody's considering leaving one of these organizations, what's the first step?
I think reach out to organizations like Life After Hate. We're right now the only nonprofit operating on the U.S. soil who is providing those types of services and resources for men and women and support for men and women trying to get out of that. Secondly, communities have to be willing to put aside their personal judgments and sentiments about what they've been doing up until that point in order to provide some service and support. Otherwise, we could just reinforce the idea that they don't have any place to go, and one or two things happen. They either go back to the groups that they just came from, or they isolate, and then they never get any better, and they're still just as likely to cause harm.
Sammy Rangel, sorry for the problems. Thank you so much for joining us today, though. I appreciate your time.
Absolutely.
Sammy
Thank
Rangel,
you, Ann. Thank you,
you
so much.
Sammy Rangel is Executive Director of Life After Hate. We'll have a link to their website at WOSU.org/allsides. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.